Pump up the volume on your parenting with Parent Pump Radio. Tune into something different that makes a difference. At Parent Pump Radio, instead of a ripple, we choose to create a splash. Get energized, get inspired, and get informed with how to parent in the new millennium with your host and parent coach super guide, Jacqueline T.D. Nguyen.
Hi, this is Jacqueline T.D. Nguyen. We're here to pump up your parenting skills, pump up your knowledge, and pump up your energy. Welcome to Parent Pump Radio. Our show is available on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, and syndicated on missionsradio.org and liveleadplay.com. So go to parentpumpradio.com to leave your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. And please subscribe to our RSS feed so you'll be automatically notified of new show. So today we're going to be talking about something serious, actually. It's our teens are relieving emotional pain. They're using cutting and other self-inflicted injury. According to a 2008 publication, now this is 2008, this was the earliest I could find from the U.S. National Library of Medicine, they reported the following regarding non-suicidal self-injury. The statistic shows that one-third to one-half of U.S. adolescents have engaged in some type of self-injury. Cutting and burning are the most common types of non-suicidal self-injury. 70% of the teens engaging in self-injury behavior have made at least one suicide attempt, and 55% had made multiple suicide attempts. Our guest today is a returning guest, and she is an amazing therapist and has been such a contributing knowledge to our show. She's a licensed professional clinical counselor, is certified as a drug and alcohol addiction counselor with the California Certification Board of Alcohol and Drug Counselors. She's also a licensed marriage and family therapist. She practices in Newport Beach and Laguna Niguel in California. She is also a guest author for DivorceMoms.com and is also a contributor to many national and international news publications, where she provides her insights and guidance to readers on relationship, mental health, and how to achieve overall well-being. So ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce you to Lisa Bahar. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jacqueline. Thank you so much for having me here today.
Oh, thank you for being here. And I also like to introduce my co-host, Brian Chow.
Hello, Jacqueline. Thank you for having me on the show again.
He's been a contributing special guest speaker on our show before in the Teen to Parent segment. He's also been helping me behind the scene, and he is an incoming junior at the University of Pennsylvania. What are you studying there, Brian?
I'm studying cognitive neuroscience.
He's going to be a really smart. If not, he's really, really smart.
I don't know about that. But I'm trying my best.
So you can contact Lisa at her website. It's Lisa Bahar, L-I-S-A, B like boy, A-H-A-R.com. Her phone number is 949-212-2081. And her Facebook page is facebook.com/Lisa Bahar, LMFT. And all of that's in the show notes. So let's just get right into here. Lisa, how long have you been in this field of business?
This is a second career for me. So I've been in this field for close to 10 years.
And I also have a follow-up question to that. I'm always really curious to know why people get into this line of work. So I want to ask you, what got you started in this field?
Well, that's a very good question. Well, first of all, it was my second career choice. My first career was working in film and television. So I was very much involved with the entertainment field and working in development and studying characters and people, and actually consulting with people like yourself to enhance and bring dimension to characters. And as a result of that, I did a certain period of time working in Los Angeles and decided to actually change my career for a variety of personal reasons, including family and having to take care of family and some of the challenges that I was dealing with personally, that I wanted to go into my own kind of therapy, which led me into learning a lot about myself. So it's kind of a multi-layered decision. It was initially through just studying people, through developing characters, to studying myself and reflecting on myself as a character, and then taking it one step further and helping other people have a way to reflect on themselves. So I went ahead and changed my career and went back to school and decided to become a licensed therapist. And I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Wow.
Yeah. What keeps you in this business? Because this is a lot of this stuff is like today we're talking about emotional cutting. It is very emotional and sad. So what keeps you going in it?
It's really about helping people. And I have a philosophy that I think the reason that people find some level of contentment and peace of mind and a meaning and purpose is in the process of helping other people. And so that guides me, and it's a calling, if you will. And I do it with respect to human beings and wanting to help others have a quiet mind and calm their mind. And I see the results, and I'm not always hitting it right, obviously, but I appreciate the opportunity to have an impact on people in a healthy way. And so I try my best to do that and maintain that kind of ethical integrity.
So let's get into the topic of the show. So what exactly is emotional cutting? I know that Jacqueline brought it up a little bit earlier.
Yes, it was introduced to me actually recently. I think it's been around for quite, like Jacqueline was talking about, 2008. I have never really discovered it and had it named in the way of emotional cutting until recently. And that's when this is a really important topic to share with people that might not be aware of it. Emotional cutting is self-inflicted, it's self-injurious behavior. And it's not using an external object, it's actually through an emotional process of self-injuring themselves. And there's a variety of ways of doing it. So that's the first part of your question. If you have any follow-up to that question, it's a self-inflicted injury and it doesn't use an object. It's actually through emotions and behavior.
So this is a little different than someone actually cutting themselves with a knife.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So how does provoking or deliberately hurting oneself help deal with its emotional pain? Because I just can't imagine if I'm in pain, inflicting more pain on myself is going to make me feel better.
Well, there's a chemical that actually can get released, but there's an endorphin rush. And there's actually an effect of self-soothing through that endorphin rush that creates that kind of surge, which creates a feeling, which increases a dopamine feel. And the individual feels something, whereas they might feel numb. They might feel empty. This kind of rush, if you will, can occur with, yes, the self-injurious behavior with, like, for example, the knife. But in this case, we're talking about emotional cutting. So this is more psychological manipulation sorts of things. And we can go further into that. Did that make sense?
Yeah. Can you give an example of what inflicting pain emotionally?
Yes. So let's take the feeling of rejection. Let's say somebody's in a relationship, and I see this more often than not, and the individual has been left by another person and feels rejected. And they're having difficulty dealing with this rejection. And so they might find themselves, for example, rereading Facebook pages of instant messages or messages, or looking at Instagram and following the individual and watching them be with other people, for example, or this kind of cyber stalking type of thing. This recreates a traumatic experience of rejection, and it's hurtful and it feels hurtful. And so it's now inflicting emotional pain deliberately.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you brought up earlier about how it's sort of like an addiction, almost like with substance use. And I know that you mentioned dopamine, and that's something that's really involved in why people get addicted, because they always want to stay on that high. Do you feel like that's something that's similar when it comes to emotional cutting, just feeling the urge to keep going back to that person or experience?
Yes, and it's progressive, like addiction. So just if you look at one message, for example, on Instagram or social media of some sort, you need to look at more and more and more. And you brought up addiction, and if we can bridge that into another piece of emotional cutting, which I have seen more often than not, that it can be actually correlated to a rush or a high. So let's say the teen, unfortunately, in this case, for example, is using drugs with the person who has rejected them. Now they're using drugs to have a high, and then on top of that, the individual rejects them. So not only did they lose the high, but they lost the person that inflicted the high and is now feeling rejected and having this self-loathing rejection feeling. So there's a variety of things that come along with teens and young adults who use drugs in addition to the emotional pain, and how those kind of overlap and play off of each other. And that's how emotional cutting plays into substance abuse and can be very addictive.
Could this increase substance abuse too then? If, say, you, like you were saying, if someone rejected them while they were getting high, it increases that. So then they would need to go back to the substance then, right?
Okay, well, then there's an after effect after they have the rejection, for example. They have a self-loathing or a self-hatred experience, and they hate themselves, let's say. They feel rejected, they hate themselves, and then on top of that, they might have gotten, if we play the pull in the substance abuse part to it, if they were getting high with that person, they don't have that euphoric feeling that that person shared with them. Unfortunately, the truth is that young people are using drugs with each other. They're using pretty sophisticated drugs with one another. This is not unusual. But not only are they losing the high, but they're also feeling the surge, but then they also have another emotion that comes along, which is the guilt or the shame or the anger. And this might provoke yet another piece to this, which is they might use substance to deal with that, or they might do other types of self-injurious behaviors.
Wow. Okay. So this is just a spiraling.
It's a cycle.
Yeah, it's a cycle. It just keeps spiraling.
There's a lot of layers to it, it sounds like.
Yeah. What are these kids hoping to feel with emotional cutting?
Better.
Okay.
They want to feel better.
But does it really feel better, though?
That's the irony of it. Yes.
Okay.
But it does have an effect that works. So that's the difficult part to actually accept, is that it does work. It helps them feel, and they feel better. It's the after effects that are difficult to understand and how to cope with, which creates the cycle.
So you're saying, like, they're going back to their Instagram account, to the letters that their ex was writing to them when they were together, like, that makes them feel better for them that moment when they're reading it. And then
they're back into that land of fantasy and reading and rereading and then remembering and then crying and then missing. They're feeling something.
Okay. Now the emotional high is gone, and then they're back down to that low.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I could actually shed some light on this, because I actually kind of went through something like this earlier this year. I was actually in a relationship for about 8 months. And when we split up in January, I found myself like wanting to read back some of the old messages just to sort of relive that feeling of attachment, knowing what it's like to feel close to someone else.
Right.
Yeah. From your experience, is emotional cutting ever progressive? In other words, does it build and get worse, or to get the same relief of feeling pain?
I would say, in my experience in working with emotional cutters, if it's not addressed clinically or otherwise, then yes, it's progressive and it can become a serious pattern. Can it take other forms? Yes. So the progressiveness can get more severe. Can it take, for example, if they attach to another individual, I built on your word, attach to another individual, but if they get involved with somebody else that serves as a distraction, then maybe the self-injurious behavior will decrease because they're now involved with somebody else that's serving the needs that the cutting or the emotional cutting was using or was serving. But in answer to your question, yes, if the person doesn't treat it or people are not aware of what they're doing, it's going to get progressive until somebody does become aware of it or if they decide to ask for help.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Can this lead to suicide?
Well, I listened to your statistics and it was one out of three or five of emotional cutters have at least committed or at least tried to commit suicide one time.
What is it? 70% of teens engaging in self-injury behavior have made at least one suicide attempt, and 55% made multiple suicide attempts.
Okay, so then we'll look at diagnosis. So a diagnosis might come into play here where it might be major depression. It might be borderline personality disorder. It might be bipolar disorder. These sorts of clinical diagnoses come into play to determine whether or not, the medication is going to be a help. It might be a psychotic episode. So will the self-injurious behavior lead to a suicide attempt? Well, according to your statistics, there's a correlation there, but that doesn't mean causation. But there's probably a very strong correlation, and generally it's coming in line with a diagnosis, a firm diagnosis.
Okay. Now, these are statistics says it's from non-suicidal self-injury. I don't know if it's actual physical cutting with the knife of what we're talking about, which is emotional cutting. That's why I was asking if the emotional cutting could lead to the physical stuff. But from what you said, it definitely makes sense that anything could lead down that way if the person doesn't recognize what's going on and get help for it, or can at least stop what they're doing.
Yeah, they're falling in line with the idea of not being able to cope and take care of themselves. So they're a danger to themselves. And it's, you know, it's depending on the severity and how far they're going with this, then there's a strong likelihood based on probably a diagnosis would fall in line with suicidal ideation. It wouldn't be a big reach. The actual correlation to that, I don't have the firm statistics,
yeah.
But I would, as a therapist, be definitely on the clinical alert that that would be a likelihood.
Okay. I know some people will say that emotional cutting is a form of resolving unresolved trauma. I'd like to hear what you have to say about what that means. And then, Brian, I'd like to hear, because you've been studying about the ACE study, which is about unresolved trauma, childhood trauma. Mm-hmm. Lisa, can you share what this means, unresolved trauma, and how it affects the emotional cutting?
Well, let's say example. A situation is where someone maybe has grown up in a domestic violent environment, and there was a lot of arguing, physical, verbal, emotional violence, maybe even sexual violence, and the child grows into an adult. They might find themselves seeking out individuals that fall in line with what they experienced through their conditioning through childhood. And the theory behind that is that they're recapitulating or recreating a traumatic pattern in their upbringing. This is what they know and what they're conditioned to seek out. And the idea behind resolved trauma or unresolved trauma is that one might find themselves recreating the same dynamic they had with the unresolved trauma in their relationships. So they might start to provoke, if you will. This is not about blame, but they might start to manipulate and provoke another reaction in the individual that they're involved with, which creates a reaction to their action and then starts an escalated situation that both are participating in, all with an underlying theory that one or both is trying to resolve past trauma or a traumatic event. So that's the idea behind self-injurious behavior, is whatever form this takes, there is a theory behind it that it's an attempt to deal with trauma.
This is just a symptom that we got to go back to that root cause, which is the And have you heard of the ACEs study, Lisa?
I have not. I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, the Adverse Childhood Experience, or ACE study, was something that was conducted in 1997 by Kaiser. And basically what it was, it took a cohort of individuals.
18,000, right?
Yeah, around that number. Right. It was a really big study. It tried to correlate adverse childhood experiences or childhood traumas, emotional abuse, etc., to current adverse health behaviors. So, for example, like smoking habits, drinking habits, drug abuse, depression, mental illness, other stuff. And what they found was that the more adverse childhood experiences someone had, the more likely they were to develop those adverse health behaviors. And as a result, the more likely they would be to suffer from some sort of ailment or even put themselves at risk of death. And I think it's really interesting that you bring this up, because when we talk about emotional cutting, I can definitely see it as something that someone would partake in to sort of recreate that early childhood trauma as a means of sort of coping with it. I feel like a lot of people who engage in this stuff aren't exactly aware that the reasons why they do this comes from something that might have happened when they were younger or might have roots in something that happened a long time ago. But I think that's really interesting how you bring that up and how it's sort of a way to, I guess, process emotionally a lot of the stuff that's going on.
Yeah, I really like it too. Yeah. You really brought up people that I know. You had parents that argue, maybe parents that were alcoholics, and this is prevalent in childhood. When you said you, as an adult, recreate those things, those moments, in order to resolve what you couldn't resolve as a child because you didn't have that capability of resolving it. So it really makes sense.
Yeah, I like it. And I can appreciate what Brian was talking about as well, how those studies actually validate the theory behind that.
Brian did a show on it.
Oh, he did. Oh, I've got to listen.
Yeah, look it up. We have some really great TED Talk videos that's already on the show notes too. And it's really powerful.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of really great stuff.
Over 18,000 participants answered these questions.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's profound.
And I actually want to go back to what you were saying earlier about how teens may use this sort of as a way to sort of help others understand that they're in distress, or in a way sort of manipulate others, including parents, as a way to provoke a reactive response. How does this work exactly, and what can parents do to not get caught in the cycle? Because when we talk about this, I mean, I can imagine that parents also have their own unresolved trauma that they might have experienced when they are younger. And when teens engage in this sort of behavior with their parents or loved ones, I can imagine it just spiraling into a vicious cycle.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. It's very multi-layered. With our culture, you know, parents are working, and, you know, it's sometimes hard. I'm assuming parents are working. I'm making a big assumption there. But sometimes this kind of self-injurious behaviors is very quiet. It's a quiet emotional trauma and traumatic way of dealing. And what I mean by quiet is it's very hidden, and it's not always so apparent. And so it's a challenge for parents, and I sympathize with the awareness factor of it. But I think the first part is to just know that these are things that are happening, and be willing to notice things that don't feel quite right. It's hard to discern between a young teen being just atypical, respectfully rebellious, or just being your atypical teenager who doesn't want to do or whatever and get mad at mom and dad if someone or whoever's raising them. But there's also another defining factor of, is there isolation going on? Who are they around? How much social media is taking place within their lives? Who are they with? Be willing to check on these sorts of things. And it doesn't mean you have to be a helicopter parent, but it does mean you have to be a helicopter parent. So there's a fine balance of being kind of a quasi-plain helicopter parent. Be there, aware, and be willing to check their body. If there's something that feels like a mark, or there's something going on there that doesn't seem quite right, or they're overusing their cell phone, be willing to check their cell phones. I think just be aware of things. And that's a very broad way of guiding parents. But the first part is just awareness. And then talk to their teens. Ask them, do they know people who have been involved with this? Are they willing to educate them? Give teens an opportunity to parent the parent on this one. Kind of turn the tables on them, if you will, because teens love to parent their parents. So, so talk to them and be willing to learn from them. And if you notice these dramatic fights that go beyond what seems or appears just atypical teenage behavior, you know, they're provoking an emotional reaction in you, that there's something else underneath that. What's really going on here? Just notice that. And sometimes that requires a therapist or a mental health professional that can help them and talk to them about that.
Yeah, because me hearing all this, I mean, I can definitely think of a situation where both the teens and the parents aren't entirely aware of everything that's going on in the background. And a lot of times people don't necessarily have the tools or awareness to really understand what it is that's going on.
Yeah, and once anger takes in, once the rage takes in, the high intense emotion, I think it's hard for parents or the teens to really recognize the actual cause of it.
Yeah, and you know what's hard with teens, I hear this more often than not in working with them, is they're the first ones to call their parents out. Well, you do it. You're bulimic. Okay. I see you go in the bathroom. These are self-injurious behaviors in their own form. You know, okay. I'm just using bulimia as one example, or restricting or whatever, over-exercising. So if they're watching parents do their form of self-injurious behaviors, that's a hard call for parents to actually go, wow, you know, it's not easy stuff to face your own stuff through your kids. But that does happen, and it is relevant. I'm just kind of throwing it out there.
Yeah, no, you're right. And I just think of alcohol. And because alcohol is legal, parents do use it, and the children can just say that back. You know, well, you use it for when you're stressed or angry or whatever it is to calm you down. And so why can't I just binge?
Right. Yeah, true.
What are some psychotherapy treatment that's going on right now or is there any that can help with emotional cutting? Because I think it's really hard to tell because it's not a physical sign that you can look out for.
Well, that's very true. And talk therapy is helpful. So insight therapy, kind of what we were talking about earlier with trauma and unresolved trauma, that is effective if the teen is willing and open to doing that. And I've noticed they have been, you know, not all teens are, but sometimes they are willing to actually explore some of these things in a trusted environment. Not always, but I've seen that work for teens. Being aware of the patterns and just noticing the patterns and then providing skills. I do a lot of DBT work with my clients. So I'll educate them on DBT skills, and they might not use them right at that time, but at least they've been introduced into the brain. So I'll teach them some DBT skills that they can practice and use. And that's the beauty of DBT, in my opinion. It's very subtle in how it can provide an ability to master your own mind and be able to self-soothe without doing an injurious act. So DBT, I think, is very helpful. And parent education, so parent participation of not singling out just the teen. Let's take a look at the family and somehow consider it a family challenge versus just a teen challenge. So the whole family on some level is participating in this, even though the child is acting it out or the teen is acting it out with their boyfriend or girlfriend or whoever. There's something going on there that the family deserves to have some sort of opportunity to look at their role in the situation. There's no blame. Avoid blame. So there's no blaming anybody. It's just somehow this works. And what is that about? And how does it affect the family? And everybody gets to participate in the treatment, including the family dog or the cat.
Interesting. I actually have a final question as well. After hearing everything you said, I could totally imagine a kid being in a spot where he or she might feel isolated, might want to engage in behavior that is reminiscent of emotional cutting just to help him or her get through whatever it is that he or she is going through. Does the ideal internal dialogue sound like? I know that you mentioned DBT and CBT, but could you kind of just give an example of what a conversation someone should have with him or herself?
Well, these are with negative self-talk, and they come in the form of self-loathing. So most likely it's something about, I hate myself, I'm not worth it, I don't deserve to be loved, if only I would change, everything would be better, everyone hates me. There's a lot of absolutes, a lot of always and nevers and everyone's. Life is not worth it, I wish I were never born, why me, how come he doesn't love me, what makes her better? I'm ugly. I'm fat. So these might be some. Does that answer your question, Brian?
Yeah, I was actually wondering, like, what conversation should someone be having with him or herself? So this person might be thinking all these thoughts on the inside. Yeah, and what and taking into account, all the stuff that they could possibly use to help.
Okay, so with FAIR, I would use what we call challenge the myths in your mind. So number one, we would look at the negative self-talk or what they're telling themselves, because you know the brain interprets things that happen. So if someone doesn't say hi, what does the mind tell them? What is the statement that they're telling themselves when that happens, for example? And then I would say challenge that myth. And what I mean by challenge is, yes, do the opposite. Say the opposite. Well, they hate me. Well, is that a fact? No, you don't know. But they're acting like they do. But is that a fact that they do? So I might challenge that in that regard. And then have them modify that statement. They may act like they hate me, but actually they have demonstrated at times that they actually like me. So something to that effect. So really pulling them into the gray area and challenging their cognitive distortions and being able to tell themselves that they're okay. It might come in the form of, I am safe. I am happy. I can be peaceful. If they can't do that with themselves, maybe they can wish that on somebody that they do care about. I don't know. I'm taking your question a step further on like a compassion practice for themselves, but it's really about learning how to accept yourself, but learning how to take it step by step. because at first they're not going to believe, oh, I love myself. I love myself. But they might over time, if they continue to do those affirmations. But just calling the negative self-talk out and then challenging that myth and then building that into a neutral statement that's non-judgmental of self. Did that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's wonderful. I think that's really great to try and get in the habit of doing, especially when you are in that dark place and it's really hard to acknowledge self-worth and self-love and all that stuff. So I think that's really good.
You made a really good point that we're not trying to swing the pendulum all the way to the other side, because they're at that point, they might not love themselves, but just to get into the gray area. So it's not so definitive on one end is a step in that right direction.
That's very important, because we go into this absolute thinking, the nevers and the always and everyone's. And so we pull in the gray area, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We are actually out of time, and I know we can talk about this for a lot longer, Lisa, and go into a lot of the things, but I just want to thank you so much for shining light on this so that parents can look out for this. Like you said, even bulimia is a form of emotional cutting. Hopefully the awareness comes so that then the prevention can happen after that. Do you have any final thing to say, Brian and Lisa?
No, I'm okay.
Okay, Lisa?
Well, no, I'm okay too. And I thank you again for having me on Parent Pump. It was great to talk to you too, Brian. And I hope this helps our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you, listener. Until next time, always be learning and always be growing. Thank you so much for joining us today. Go to parentpumpradio.com and click on the pink box on the top of our homepage to listen to our new and archived shows. To be instantly notified of new episodes, subscribe to our RSS feed. The RSS feed button is located at the top of the page where all our shows are featured. And after listening to the show, go to parentpumpradio.com or our Facebook page to leave your comments, questions, and topic suggestions. And while you're at our website, sign up to receive a free gift. Until next time, have a wonderful week.